Welcome to Personal Landscapes. I'm your host, Ryan Murdoch. You can find links for today's episode and other conversations on Books About Place at ryanmurdoch.com. In the late 1800s, during the Victorian era, a moderately successful doctor in Southsea created a fictional character so compelling that people wrote letters to him asking for help. Sherlock Holmes became a literary sensation, in part thanks to a boom in the mass circulation periodicals where most of the stories first appeared. Holmes fans spanned the range from casual to obsessive, and they included the last sultan of the Ottoman Empire to hold absolute power. That fact set today's guest off on the marvelous flight of fancy that became his first novel. Andrew Finkel is the author of The Adventure of the Second Wife, Sherlock Holmes and the Ottoman Empire, and of Turkey, What Everyone Needs to Know. His work as a Turkey-based correspondent has appeared in a wide range of print and broadcast media, including The Times, The Economist, and Foreign Affairs. He's also a founding member of P24, an Istanbul-based NGO that supports press freedom and independent journalism. I loved the Sherlock Holmes stories as a child, and it was a great pleasure to revisit that world, something I haven't done since I was maybe 11 or 12. We spoke about the Sherlock Holmes craze, the dying days of the Ottoman Empire, and the nature of obsession. Before we get into today's episode, I'd like to take a second to tell you about my new book. It's called A Sunny Place for Shady People, and it's about 6 years I spent on the island of Malta. I went there because I wanted to write an island book inspired by Lawrence Thurl. And there was light and laughter in those early years, but then there was an election, and everything changed. I watched an organized criminal network take over the government of a European Union member state with the widespread support of its citizens. It culminated in the brutal car bomb assassination of a writer I admired, the investigative journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia. The office of the Prime Minister was implicated in her murder, but no politicians have been arrested or charged. My book attempts to show why a journalist could be killed in broad daylight in such a small place, and why those who ordered the hit have gotten away with it. I think the roots of it all are deeply embedded in the culture. It's a dark story and an important one. I hope you'll consider reading it. You can find A Sunny Place for Shady People at your favorite bookshop and online in all the usual places. And now, back to this week's conversation. So what was your first encounter with Sherlock Holmes?
Well, my first encounter was probably like most people as a child. I had this book of great detective stories, and I think The Speckled Band was one of them, and The Red-Headed League was one of them. And I think that's probably where I left it for a very long time. I mean, I enjoyed them, and I thought they were great, but I wasn't addicted to them. And then I came across a passage, some time ago, not in a book about Sherlock Holmes, but in a book about Istanbul, which is where I lived and worked, and still do. Basically it described Abdulhamid II, who was the last great, powerful Ottoman sultan who ruled for 40 years and was finally overthrown by the Young Turks. And this passage was describing the enigma that was Abdulhamid, that he was both, a traditionalist and a modernist, that he bring his country into the world, but at the same time, was lagging behind. And it said, and one of the paradoxes was that he would have the Quran read to him, but he would also have Sherlock Holmes stories read to him, and Sherlock Holmes adventures read to him from behind the arras at night by his foster brother, his the son of his milk nurse, who was a high dignitary at court. And so this notion of, the shadow of God on earth, listening to Sherlock Holmes as he went to bed at night was the great hero of popular culture. It was just such a striking image that I thought, well, there's something in this. I have to explore this. And that's... So rather late in life, I went back to Sherlock Holmes that's where it all began.
So did you end up reading all the stories at that point later?
Well, I suppose I did eventually. I the story, the book, The Adventure of the Second Wife, is sort of not exactly set, but the main character is a member of this really quite, I suppose, fanatical is too strong a word, but you know, he's a Sherlock Holmes enthusiast and he loves Sherlock Holmes and he hangs out with other people who are addicted to Sherlock Holmes, and together they try and he tries to solve this great literary mystery about Sherlock Holmes. But I have to say, I wasn't an addict myself. This was a time when I guess, you know, I started looking Sherlock Holmes up on the internet and of course discovered that there was this huge, you know, community of people who you know, breathed and sighed over Sherlock Holmes and would spend hours trying to figure out whether there was a train at 8:12, which would have gotten Watson to Waterloo, you know, from Waterloo in time for to solve a particular mystery. So this, it just seemed too, you know, too rich a thing to pass up not to write about.
That's interesting. It seems like everybody kind of encounters this character in their childhood at some point. Like for me, it was The Hound of the Baskervilles. It must have been, I think, it's maybe fourth or fifth grade. We had this Scholastic book club, and they would send a catalog, I think, once a month. And my parents always let me pick a book out of it, and I chose that one. And it scared the absolute bejesus out of me. This dog. And I think probably over the next 2 or 3 years, I went on to read all the stories and novels pretty well around, you know, fifth grade, sixth grade sort of thing. And I haven't read any of them since until I came across your book here.
Yeah.
But actually, I did. In hindsight, I don't know why that dog scared me so much. Because I stumbled on Baskerville Hall. It's in, it's outside Hay on Wye. I was doing a magazine story and they hooked us up with this drug squad detective and we were chasing the roots of King Arthur, which was his obsession. And we were driving down the road and he said, you guys like Sherlock Holmes? I said, yeah. Do you want to see Baskerville Hall? It's right around the corner. So we went into this place and it was full on, just like the description, like the above the door, you see the dog's head with a dagger driven through it and the blood dripping out. But the funniest thing was we found in the forest behind this place, the caretaker pointed out some graves. There was like a pet cemetery. It was a really gloomy, creepy forest, but the names on it said like Patch and Nip and Sally. And, yes. And there was one from 1838. It said our well-loved little doggy. So I think this was the hound that terrified me as a kid.
The well-loved little doggy. Yes. I mean, what attracted me, I guess, wasn't so much the scary element of the stories. I think that's a rare one, which is scary, but I guess it's just the characterizations. It's what everyone loves about. It's not so much the mysteries. The mysteries in many ways are, you know, very pedestrian. I mean, they're not that exciting. It's the setup. It's the characters. It's the, you know, the American situation comedy aspect of it all, that you have two characters who appear not every week, but once a month in the Strand magazine, who, you know, the brilliant detective who can solve, you know, who knows what you're thinking by them. You know, the way you hold your pen, and the rather dim sidekick who you know marvels at his clever friend, and you know that sort of characterization is, I think, is what appeals to, certainly what appealed to me, and I think what appeals to a lot of people.
So I guess we should probably set the stage, because we can't take it for granted that listeners will know who the world's first consulting detective was. So for him, life began when a client walked through his door. That he knew the intimate details of their lives as well as themselves was a bit of hocus pocus that made him different from other mortals. So he appeared in a set of four novels and 58 short stories created by Arthur Conan Doyle between 1887 and 1927. And you mentioned that they were first published in the Strand magazine. So would it be an overestimation to say that Sherlock Holmes created a craze in London at the time?
Oh, of course. I mean, people were addicted to the stories. I mean, there were great crowds waiting for the apparition, for the appearance of the Strand when it was published, and then there was of course the famous incident in which figures in my novel where Sherlock Holmes dies. Conan Doyle finally has enough of him. You know, he's fed up with Sherlock Holmes, and you know he gets letters like, you know, people write to Santa Claus, people write to Sherlock Holmes to ask them to, you know, where their car keys are and where. You know, what happened to their wife and, you know, their partner embezzled their, you know, Conan Doyle was getting, you know, bags full of letters and he couldn't stand it anymore. And so he decides to kill Sherlock Holmes, and he and Moriarty grapple on the Rickenbach Falls in Switzerland, and they both apparently fall to their deaths. And this, of course, all of England went into mourning. I mean, the Prince of Wales wore a black armband, mourning for Sherlock Holmes. And of course, eventually Conan Doyle's accountant forced him to bring Sherlock Holmes back to life just to pay the bills. And that happens with the Hound of the Baskervilles, the story, the novella, the one novella that you mentioned.
I didn't realize it was 8 years until he brought him back, resurrected him. And then he actually wrote more stories after that. That like there were 26, I think, before he killed him off, and then 34 came later.
And the later ones, I think, are a bit dull, to be perfectly honest.
Especially the very late, the latest ones, the very final collection there was not the peak, yeah.
No, they're not. I mean, of course, all the excitement really is in the characterizations, not so much in the mysteries. For me anyway,
Yeah,
that's
exactly. No, it's this character, this rich character that's so interesting. So there are 95 investigations mentioned in the Sherlock Holmes stories, but never published as stories of their own, just kind of name dropped by Dr. Watson. Did you invent yours, The Adventure of the Second Wife?
Of course. I mean, the premise, there are two premises to my book, that The Adventure of the Second Wife. One is that, which is true, is that Abdul Hamid II, the Ottoman Sultan, loved Sherlock Holmes. And there's various accounts, historical accounts of key moments in his life when he was. When he, for example, when he was overthrown, apparently he was reading a Sherlock Holmes story, waiting for the Praetorian guard to turf him out of the palace. And then there's this famous moment when he's in exile and having been overthrown, and he's in Thessaloniki, and the Balkan armies are approaching and are about to conquer it from the Ottomans after centuries, and they're trying to evacuate him. They didn't want him to fall into enemy hands. And the first thing he asks, the people who are liberating him is, is Sherlock Holmes still entertaining the world? It obviously figured loomed large in his imagination. And that's the true premise. The fictional premise, or maybe it's not fictional, who knows, it could have happened, is that Arthur Conan Doyle was asked on his, towards the end of his life, which of the Sherlock Holmes adventures he liked the best. And he said, well, I hated them all because no one remembers me for my serious work, because he wrote lots of other things, historical novels and this and that, and political work as well. But he said, there is one adventure which continues to intrigue me, which is the adventure of the second wife. But of course, there is no adventure of the second wife. And as you say, and this Sherlock Holmes community, of course, for them, this is the mystery. And what did Conan Doyle mean when he said this? And my slightly eccentric narrator finds a clue and tries to solve this mystery. And of course, it completely upends his life as he does this. But that's another story.
So it's really interesting how you've woven so many threads through this this book as well, the mystery of the story, then what he uncovers, which I won't spoil, and the historical narrative as well of what was happening in Istanbul at this time. So give us a sense of Abdul Hamid. You've said a few things about him, like Philip Mansell in his Constantinople, City of the World's Desire, described him as a collection of antitheses. Subtle and silly, brave and frightened, cruel and tolerant, modern and traditionalist. What was going on in the Ottoman world at that time?
Well, the empire was under threat. I mean, it was basically held together by the fact that the Western, the great powers couldn't allow it to collapse because there would be too great a power vacuum. And Abdul Hamid was quite clever at the in the way that he managed to play one off against the other. And of course, once he was overthrown, his successors weren't quite so clever, and the empire did indeed collapse at the end of the First World War, and was replaced by the country we know today of Turkey. The thing about Abdul Hamid is that Philip, of course, writes about the paradoxes, but that paradox is in many ways run deeper, because to the generation that succeeded Abdul Hamid, he was the great villain. He was the autocrat, the dictator, the man who was responsible for the end of empire, who put his own personal advantage above those of his people. And then gradually his reputation became rehabilitated, so that the current generation, certainly the people who you know govern Turkey now and possibly you know follow in his autocratic footsteps, idolize Abdülhamid as the great you know nationalist savior of Turkey who tried to preserve the empire against the Western powers, who you know stood up for religion, who stood up for tradition, who stood up for you know, Turkishness. So you have this great paradox between you know who was this man, and you know I am faced with this dilemma. And of course, my answer to it is that you know he was someone who liked Sherlock Holmes.
So why did they think that he was he put his own advantage over that of the country?
Well, he was very very wealthy. And he managed his estates and his personal interests very well. And indeed, one of the conditions when he was in exile was that they made him assign over his wealth to the nation. And there was quite a lot of it. So like any autocrat, he may have looked after his country, but he also looked after number one as well.
But he also promulgated the Ottoman Empire's first constitution. Was that against his will?
It was very much against his will. I mean, he came to power unexpectedly because his uncle had died. The Sultan had died, and his uncle's successor, Murad IV, was basically mentally unstable. And there was the year of three sultans. I mean, basically one sultan either committed suicide or was murdered, no one really knows. The other was overthrown because he was mentally unstable. So Abdülhamid rather unexpectedly came to power himself. There was a constitution that was promulgated very much in defiance of him, but he basically declared that constitution in abeyance, and he it wasn't until he was overthrown that it was reinstated.
It's quite a turbulent period too. This 33-year period of decline. So there were rebellions in the Balkans. There was an unsuccessful war with Russia, and then I guess a more successful war with Greece at that time. And as you say, everything was sort of tempered by the greater powers, Britain being one of them, trying to keep a lid on things and keep it more or less stable. I suppose they didn't want Russia to have too much of an advantage there.
Well, that's true. And of course, there's another one of my characters is again someone drawn from real life who was a barrister who born in Pune in India, and he basically was a journalist and a barrister, and he wrote these large articles, these long articles in journals at the time, trying to defend the Ottoman Empire and saying that, you know, the attitude certainly of the liberal government of Gladstone in trying to, you know, vilify the Ottoman Empire was all wrong, because this would allow Russia to step in and it would pose a direct threat to India. And his concern, of course, was very much for the Muslim population of India. And he saw that if the British were to withdraw or be defeated in India, that his community would be the one to suffer. So he was this great defender of Abdülhamid. So some of this political, I mean, the thing is, I'm a journalist, and if I want to write about politics or about history, I can do so. I have, you know, places to do that. But it's not really, I mean, all the history seeps into the edges of the book. It's you know, it permeates the book, but it's not really an analysis of those events. I mean, it's a novel. It's a story, but it's a complex one, and one which tries to, you know, encompass years and different attitudes.
It is helpful, though, to understand that bit of history and how turbulent it was at the time, because it sort of sets up a key event that you mentioned in the book, but also to put it in the context of my podcast. This is around the same time as the Great Game. I guess that's happening in Central Asia. I just did a series of articles about Uzbekistan, and I've done a few podcasts related to the Great Game. So this is still firmly within this interesting time period.
Well, this is part of the game, of course. The novel is about people growing old, but it's also about the end of empire. So it's the end of empire is always a very evocative time. And you know, what is the new? What is the old? Is there a great difference between them? And so there's, I try and those characters who grow old in the book and who next generations, and I try and sort of, you know, mirror this end of empire in the succession of characters in the book, but that's certainly a theme.
So I want to come back to Abdul Hamid's Sherlock Holmes obsession. You write that so eagerly did he await the appearance of a fresh adventure that a special courier was on hand to catch the Dover train the moment the latest copy of The Strand left the presses. Like, was that true? Did he really have people waiting in London for the next story?
Maybe. I don't really know.
Well, you said, and you also said that stories are translated for him by a special bureau in the Yildiz Palace, and that these can be found in the archives.
Well, that may or may not be true, but they were
you completely had me hooked there.
They certainly were translated. The actual truth that I think is that, I mean, I have him read his first Sherlock Holmes story in 1893. In fact, it was much later. I think it was in the early 20th century that he became. It was after Sherlock Holmes came back to life at what's it called, the Adventure of the Something House. It's the first story when Sherlock Holmes is revived, the Empty House or something. And I think that was the first one that Abdul Hamid read. So it was later. He did have detective fiction translated for him, and indeed there's this. There's this very famous Turkish archaeologist called Hali Cembel, who was quite a remarkable woman. She was a fencing champion, and she was the first woman, I think probably the first Muslim woman at all, to be in an Olympics. This was in the 36 Olympics in Berlin, and she refused to shake Hitler's hand. This was the Olympics where Hitler refused to shake Jesse Owens' hand, but Hali Cembel refused to shake Hitler's hand. And her father was an official, and he translated detective fiction for Abdul Hamid, which is something I discovered much later. I mean, she was a great woman, but even greater for the fact that her father was a translator. So these things did happen. Some of the detail I rather embroidered, I have to say, but I'm glad you fell for it anyway.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. Well, it raises interesting questions too about the translation and how things get shifted between cultures and some minor misunderstandings or assumptions about a story. Like the way you played with some of the titles was really interesting. I think the speckled band became something about a cummerbund.
Well, I guess the idea was to make sure that it did understand that Abdul Hamid heard these stories through a glass darkly, as it were. I mean, there's when he hears that when he hears there's a dog cart, for example, in the speckled band, and somehow this translated as a cart being drawn by a dog, and this completely throws Abdul Hamid. You know, is that, you know, are the dogs in England so big that they can actually pull a carriage? You know, there is a story that is interwoven in the pastiche that is interwoven in the book, which reflects on the action. And of course, that is the idea, is you're meant to feel that this is a translation, and that people perceiving events through different optics.
It raises some questions too, and casts further doubt on the mystery, like whether the adventure of the second wife was just a mistranslation for an existing story. And so there's a lot of other layers as well that you've woven in there that was really, really keeps you hooked. The Abdul Hamid actually gave Conan Doyle a medal, the Order of the Majidi, second class, in 1907. So did he actually meet the Sultan?
Well, I'm not sure about this. I mean, this really is a mystery. If you read, Conan Doyle writes memoirs in which he went on his second honeymoon. Conan Doyle's first wife died and he remarried. And they went on a honeymoon. And the boat was in Istanbul. And what he writes in his memoirs is that it was Ramadan, so the Sultan couldn't see him for some reason. I mean, I guess, but he did get these medals. These were sort of honorifics. His wife was given the medal of Nishani Shevkat, which is the order of compassion, of kindness, but then there's another memoir by someone called Woods Pasha, who was I guess you'd call him a mercenary now, but he was they used to call them renegades, and basically he was an English admiral who worked for the Ottoman Navy, and he writes in his memoirs that Abdul Hamid did see Sri Lanka, and so whether he did or not is sort of, you know, well, it's not a great mystery, but it's unresolved. That's a legitimate mystery.
Well, there was one mention of a Sultan of Turkey in a real Sherlock Holmes story, The Adventure of the Blanched Soldier. That's one of those later ones. And this is one of only two stories narrated by Holmes rather than Dr. Watson. And based on the dates, the Sultan that he would have performed the services for would have been Abdul Hamid.
Yes, that's true. Because that story, I think, was written, you know, well after the Ottoman Empire was over. I can't remember what, 1928 or something.
I think the last one was 27. So it must have been. It was in the 20s for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, it's in the 20s. So Abdul Hamid was well and truly, you know, a memory by then. But yes,
I noticed too that in the 1984 TV series with Jeremy Brett, there's a portrait painting on the wall at 221B of a man wearing a fez. So I wonder if that was sort of a subtle nod to the Sultan as well.
Well, you're well ahead of me there. You see, once you start this thing, you can't stop.
You've got me obsessed now. Like,
and well, you can see where this is leading. Yes, I think that. I mean, that's part of the sort of what the book is about, is that people, you know, grasp, you know, following things where they lead, and not being able to stop.
Yeah, you've got me looking for clues everywhere. I mean, I told you earlier that around the time I read your book, I decided to plunge back into Holmes and refresh my memory. I ended up blasting through four books, and now we've started watching that old 1984 TV series again. Like, I watched it when I was 12, and my wife is never, she's Japanese, she's never seen this, and she's totally hooked on it as well. So,
gosh, I didn't know whether to feel, you know, proud or guilty.
You've created some sort of monster.
Well, exactly. Yes, but that's sort of, yes. That's one of the points of the book, I think, is how these things become obsessions.
So you've set this translation bureau in the Yıldız Palace, and that's no longer open to the public today, and it's not a museum anymore. I guess it's used by the president, but Abdul Hamid moved there from Dolmabahçe because he feared a seaside attack along the Bosphorus. But he wasn't just paranoid; like, people really were trying to kill him, right?
There was one well-known assassination attempt, and there's an episode in the book where Abdul Hamid's obsession with Sherlock Holmes saves him from another assassination attempt. One of my own devising, I have to say, but it's based on a real incident. Yes, he lived behind very high walls, but then, you know, as you say, a lot of people were after him. So he had good reason to be, you know, as Kissinger said, you know, some people have good reason to be paranoid.
Were there more attempts on him than other Ottoman sultans? Like, was he especially targeted?
I don't know. I only know of that one attempt to assassinate him, but obviously he was very well guarded. And of course, he never went out. This was the great thing about Abdul Hamid, was that he, I mean, I don't know if you know the late Queen Victoria, after Albert died, would never appeared in, or very rarely appeared in public. And this was a subject of great controversy at the time. Abdul Hamid very rarely went out, never went out. And you know, he was never photographed. There's only one photograph that I know of him, which was taken in the 70s when he was a prince, and he went on the only time the Ottoman family ever went to Europe was to see the Paris Exposition, and he went to England. And there's a picture of him taken in a photographic studio on Ebury Street, which is the only photographic portrait that I know of him. But there are other photos, because the one occasion which he did have to go out was for Friday prayers, and there was this great ceremony where he would leave the palace, and the mosque was very near the palace, and he would you know, go to prayers, and this was a great sort of spectacle, a weekly spectacle in the city, and he would drive the carriage back himself, you know, this and accompanied by you know panting servants who would his entourage who would run after him. So this was the one, you know, the one occasion which he would be seen in public. But you know, he didn't go around snipping ribbons. And then he was very much a closeted figure.
So you mentioned that you had to write a pastiche of a home story for your book. What was the most challenging thing about channeling Conan Doyle?
Good question. I can't remember what. Well, I think the main difficulty, I suppose, is getting the tone right, because a lot of these, I mean, let's face it, the pastiches are quite sort of tedious and boring, and the people who write them think they're very clever, but they're not actually that clever or entertaining. So, I mean, the point is, I didn't write a whole pastiche, which I said, "Oh, look at this! This is great." It's cut into snippets, and these snippets sort of reflect what else is going on in the book. So you read them at several levels, but the idea was to get the tone right, and so it didn't. A lot of these pastiches sound very antiquated. I mean, they use sort of what they think is authentic Victorian language. In fact, no one ever wrote or talked like that. It's a, you know, absurdity. On the other hand, they didn't actually talk like we do today. They didn't use words that we use today. So the idea was not to make it anachronistic. So at the time, there was, I didn't think it exists anymore, but there was a online, what's the word, compendium or whatever of all the Combe stories, and you could look up a word and see if it was actually used in the Sherlock Holmes canon, as they call it. And so I was very careful not to use words that Conan Doyle himself wouldn't have used, and to make it sound authentic. But at the same time, I didn't want it to make it sound stilted and sort of, you know, antiquated, artificially antiquated.
I guess you also have to tread a fine line too, like you do, between making it a mockery or making it kind of a knockoff in a humorous way, and trying to make it fit in as a serious possible contender as a story.
Well, I mean, at a certain point, we become aware that it's not that it's written by someone else, that it's not written by Conan Doyle, or at least there's a few surprises there, but. So there's many voices going on. There's the authorial voice is really quite confused, and I think now that I think about it, that's probably a motif in the book itself, where, you know, my different characters jostle for control of the narrative, you know, and including this Sherlock Holmes pastiche.
Yeah, and you also mentioned an Ottoman themed theater extravaganza called Constantinople at Olympia. This was a real event.
Yes, this is great.
That's amazing.
Let me tell you the whole story, as it were. Basically, I decided that the death of Sherlock Holmes would play a role in the plot, and for some reason, I had this notion that I had to read. I didn't think I had ever read the story before, and so I thought to read it for the first time, I should read it. I don't know why I felt this, but I did feel this, that I had to read it in an original copy of the Strand magazine and get this sort of sense of opening the pages and, you know, reading it as someone would have read it in December 1893 when it was first published. So in those days, there was something called the Marylebone Public Library. It doesn't exist anymore. And there was something called the Conan Doyle Collection, which was the borough of Marylebone, which also doesn't exist anymore, contribution to the 1951 Festival of Britain. And they, because they're around the corner from Baker Street, they created this special library as their contribution to the Festival of Britain. So anything to do with Conan Doyle or Sherlock Holmes is in this room. So I went there and I got a copy of the Strand magazine, you know, the sort of rather delicate copy. And on the verso, as it were, on the left-hand side, when Sherlock Holmes has fallen off the cliff and Watson is peering over the cliff and, you know, mourning the death of his friend, on the very next page is this the only photograph of Abdul Hamid ever taken on the right-hand side of the book. And it's the beginning of this completely different article about this character I described, this Indian barrister Muslim Indian barrister who was basically writing a panegyric in praise of the Ottoman Empire.
So you were already working on the novel at this time that you stumbled on this.
Yeah.
Did you think that you were maybe caught up in it? Like this?
It was like, you know, sort of a thunderbolt from God saying you had to finish this book. Of course, yeah, I took my time. It took me a while to finish it after that. But this sent me off on my own tangent. And at the very last line of this article, in parentheses, is a reference to this spectacle in the Olympia. Which was a production by this American, Hungarian, I think he became American, I'm not quite sure, Jewish impresario called Bolosi Karalfi, who he and his brother Imre were responsible for producing these huge sort of, I'm trying to think how to describe them. I guess they were like this sort of ABBA laser musical. I mean, they were completely vacuous, perhaps, in content, but really quite powerful as spectacles. And they worked with Barnum and Bailey in the United States and, you know, Madison Square Gardens. And in 1892, they converted Olympia in Kensington, in London, into a replica of Venice. And there was this spectacle twice a day of this musical spectacle, and you would take the train to Addison Road Station, which is now, I guess, the Olympia tomb stop, and you could rent a gondola, which would take you in this artificial canal into Olympia, and there was all these things you could see and then attend the spectacle. And so this was so successful that in 1893 they decided to create to turn Venice into Constantinople. And so twice a day that you had this musical spectacle with waterfalls and elephants and God knows what, and 2,000 actors, numerous. So it was like a sort of military operation. I'm staring at Bolosi Karalfi's autobiography as I talk to you and in describing this event. So basically the idea of creating these sort of, you know, what is the word, simulacrums of Constantinople and London. And then I invented perhaps, but it's not entirely improbable that Abdul Hamid, who never would leave Yildiz Palace, had a sort of model of the Bosphorus built in the grounds of the palace. So he would travel the city in this sort of replica of Istanbul inside his own palace. And in the novel, I say that this was modeled after the Olympia, after the recreation of Constantinople in West London.
But was the actual event a sort of a PR campaign for the Ottoman Empire, or this was just something the exoticizing the view of it from outside?
Well, I have a friend who's a very good historian called Selim Deringer, who writes about that the Ottomans were very conscious of their image, just as modern Turkey and a lot of countries today are very conscious of how they're represented outside of Turkey, outside of their own borders. They would be very exercised if there was a unfavorable portrayal of, you know, a harem girl on the London stage, or you know, they were very, very self-conscious of how this image was created. And I'm not sure if it's true or not, but I think this actually might be true, is that they tried that the spectacle was, I guess, in contemporary terms, quite expensive. The investment, I think it was, I don't know, £78,000 or something in 1893. So you can imagine. I don't know if that figure is correct, but it is knowable. I think to get investment, I think they even got some investment from Queen Victoria, not a lot, but that sort of primed the pump. So it became sort of a respectable thing to invest in. And I'm sure that they tried to get money from the Ottoman Empire as well, but I have no, you know, when I say I'm sure, I'm not really sure, but it seems entirely probable. This was part of an attempt to show the Abdul Hamid's realm in a favorable light. Although I have to say, the spectacle It doesn't. It ends in Constantinople, and at one point they go off to Spain. And there's one scene in I don't know, Tuscany or God knows what. I also have a copy of the program in front of me, which has the lyrics. If you want to sing along,
would you like to give a demonstration of that?
No, but I didn't know what the music was like. I did find out that I forget his name now. The composer was an Italian who wrote. I didn't think we have any record of what the music was like.
That might be for the better, actually.
I think that might be true. The lyrics are a little bit silly, I have to confess. But
you mentioned another key character in your novel, Rafiuddin Ahmed. You described him as a barrister, a tutor to Queen Victoria, diplomat, journalist, politician, educator, man about town, cat among the stuffy pigeons at court, and possibly a spy. That he is quite an interesting person. Could you give us a sense of who this guy was?
There was this famous character, the Munshi, who was Queen Victoria's Indian manservant, who she elevated into a very senior position. I think there's been some sort of, I think there was a film made about him not too long ago. Abdul Karim was his name, and he was the son of an apothecary and, you know, a bit of beefcake. And he replaced sort of John Brown in Queen Victoria's affections, and he was deeply resented and hated by the rest of the court. And when Queen Victoria died, he was basically, you know, exiled back to India. And they went to it. He had a grace and favor home in Osborne. And when Queen Victoria died, they came and they burned all the papers. They basically tried to, you know, he was very deeply resented. And he must have had this sort of mentor, this sort of eminence grise, who was Rafiuddin Ahmed, the person you refer to. And Rafiuddin Ahmed was born in Pune, near Pune, and was English educated, and was a barrister at the Inns of Court. And he was obviously much, you know, educated and clever, and was apparently used on diplomatic missions to the port, to Constantinople. But he's also, I discovered that, again in the Strand magazine, that he basically tutored Queen Victoria in Hindustani, as it was called, which I guess now would be called Urdu, I suppose. And he reproduces in the Strand her Queen Victoria writing in Arabic script, and some of the things are couplets by the Persian poet Saadi. You know, the great, who writes this book. You know, this. There's a tradition of advice to the princes and kings on how to rule in Saadi, right? The Gulistan is a famous, and she writes baits, you know, couplets in her own hand. It's really quite extraordinary. And of course, it's very much in the Hello magazine style of, you know, there I was tutoring, you know, Queen Victoria in Hindustani, and it was, you know, it's very much him, you know, showing off his intimacy with royalty I mean, he's really quite an interesting, entertaining character, and he plays a role in the book. And the one thing I feel guilty about is that he's such an interesting character that I had to invent things about him in life, and I sort of feel that his real life was much more interesting than I possibly could have imagined. But he was, in the end, he went back to India himself and was a minister for education, I think, in the Bombay government, and was knighted as a result of this. And he was always an advocate he was a member, I think, of the Muslim National Congress, and basically was very much a defender of the presence of England in India as the protectors of the Muslim community. And the one thing I discovered, which really quite shocked me, was that at some point, his enemies poisoned him, or tried to poison him, and he became blind. So at the end of his life, he was blind. But he lived, you know, into the 1950s. He lived for 90 years, I think.
So you've said also that your novel was a tale of obsession. And you've mentioned these people who either pretend Sherlock Holmes was a real person or conduct serious studies of his work. I did a little digging into some of these societies, like the Baker Street Irregulars is one. That was the first Sherlockian society, founded in 1934 by Christopher Morley. Your book mentions the Scholarly Symposium of Sherlockian Scions, which is difficult to say. But there really is an annual symposium, or there was, called the Scintillation of Scions that meets in Baltimore. Did you come across that?
No, I didn't.
So you really hit it close to the mark.
it was life imitating art, I guess. No, I did. I did invent this triple S symposium, which I call the snake, because is how the acronym is. It makes a hissing snake noise. I mean, the whole idea is that the narrator is trying to solve this mystery in time so he can present the paper at the snake symposium, and of course he trips many times along the way.
This is quite true to life, though. You write that the universe of Holmes enthusiasts is populated by people who spend hours perusing the 1883 edition of Bradshaw's with monk-like devotion to discover if there really was a 6:20 train from Leatherhead, which would have allowed Helen Stoner in The Adventure of the Speckled Band to reach Baker Street by 7:15 that fateful April morning. There's a surprising number of people like this, and a surprising number of websites as well. Like there's one where you can look up all the actual locations mentioned in all the Sherlock Holmes stories, and it gives you a map of London, of this corner of England, and you'll pinpoint actual buildings.
I'll tell you a story, which is when I was doing the book was being edited, and then this was during the pandemic, and I was in Istanbul at my desk, and I was, you know, the sub editor was in London, and we were communicating by email, of course, and at a certain point in the marginalia that she was writing were these details which no one in their right mind would know. That, for example, I refer to Conan Doyle's house in I think it's in Norwood, South Norwood, or I can't remember. And she said, "Oh, you know, it's for sale." And she sends me a link to that. There was a forced auction sale of Conan Doyle's house. And I was quite surprised by this. And then there was another thing where the memoirs of Sherlock Holmes has 12 stories in the American edition, but only 11 in the UK edition. And I didn't know this, but she knew this. and it was really quite important that we get it right in the book. And I was so impressed by this that I sort of looked her up. And of course, she was one of these people. She had written a book called, you know, Sherlock Holmes is London, and you know, knew far more about Sherlock Holmes than I possibly ever will or could. So it's, you know, again, it was this pursued me, of course. And again, apart from this great coincidence of finding Abdul Hamid and Sherlock Holmes on the same page in the Strand magazine, I did ask the librarian when we had the launch of the book. The librarian of that, I tracked the librarian who ran the Sherlock Holmes collection then and now, and who I think is now head of the Sherlock Holmes Society. And I did say. I did mention this coincidence. She nodded her head very sagely and said, "Oh yes, there's a when you, it, I'm not surprised." She says, "There's a lot of coincidences when you in the Sherlock Holmes community." so you know, Conan Doyle was a spiritualist. You know, so it's no doubt.
Perhaps he had an influence on your book. You should have.
I'm certain. Yes, I'm sure.
There's a collection in Toronto too. The Toronto Library, the big one. I don't know if it's still there, but I remember it as a teenager. I read about it in a newspaper travel section at one point. And so the first time I went to Toronto, you know, as a teenager and not a little kid, that's the first place I went to see this room, because it was supposed to have a mock-up of, you know, his study or whatever. And they had all the Strand magazines. And
I had a journalism fellowship in Michigan years ago, and we went down to Chicago to because Philip Mansell, the person who had set me off on this great tangent, who was a friend, was giving a lecture, and I become, you know, we had lunch, and then everyone went to the lecture, and I had to pick something up at the hotel or something, so I came late, and I what's it called, the Neville Library? I'm trying to remember this great fancy library, public library, not public, private library, which is famous in Chicago. And I went there, and the lecture room was packed. And I thought, you know, here it's a Saturday afternoon, and all these people are coming out to hear Philip talk about some quite esoteric aspect of, you know, Habsburg lineages or something like that. And I thought, you know, it turned out, of course, that his lecture was upstairs, and the lecture I was sitting in was about Sherlock Holmes. that it was being given by this, the brainstorm, his name escapes me, this famous Sherlock Holmes scholar whose body was discovered with garroted by it with a tennis racket or something in a locked room, and whether this was a very esoteric, you know, suicide, or whether he had been murdered. It was anyway, never mind. It is a sort of Hall of Mirrors, the Sherlock Holmes story.
So, yeah, it's just been dogging you your whole life. So you clearly weren't a Sherlock Holmes obsessive, but did you ever have an obsession like these people? Were you an obsessive in any way, or what are you obsessed with?
Oh, there's a question. I'm not sure that I am, but I suppose if I did have good question, which I don't know the answer to, but I suppose that Turkey became my obsession, and Istanbul became my obsession. And I had lived there as a kid and went back as a journalist and spent many years living and working there. And, you know, it was seeing the city that I knew as a kid of 2 million, less than 2 million people, become a city of 16 or 18 million people, and seeing, you know, the Istanbul that I knew being covered by another Istanbul, being covered by another Istanbul, but, you know, these palimpsests of Istanbul after Istanbul after Istanbul. And I guess that I was once writing a column, I had a column once for the New York Times, and I remember my editor saying, you know, if you write another, you're not allowed to write another story about urban renewal in Istanbul. You know, I was, you know, I was put in my place. So I guess if I had an obsession, it was about, it's about, you know, this sort of kaleidoscopic Istanbul that, you know, where, and I think I wrote in the book, you know, where standing still feels like falling through air. You know, it's a city that changes all the time, and I guess that became my obsession.
Yeah, you said in the book, or you described this novel as a way to connect your two adopted cultures and translate one into the other. Was that part of it, connecting Istanbul, and what's the other?
I guess that's how it started. I mean, I guess the book became my obsession, if I were really entirely truthful, which no one ever is. I mean, I came across this line from Philip about Abdulhamid and Sherlock Holmes, and I suppose there's a notion that every empire has a sort of end of empire story, like the King and I, or you know. What's the Paul Scott book about India, Jewel in the Crown, you know? I mean, there's, you know, and there is this sort of end of empire moment that or E.M. Foster, whatever, that people try and capture and is very evocative and, you know, the old and the new. And I thought, well, I'll be the chronicler of the Turkish end of empire. I'm not sure that the book turned out that way at all, but this somehow this image was the kernel of all this this slippery slide that I went down.
And the other adopted culture you wanted to connect it to was English culture.
English. Well, the thing is, I was born in Philadelphia, and so I'm not English at all. But I've lived here a lot, and I married one of them, and actually she's a Scot. She's not English. So, you know, the idea was that these, you know, that I had two cultures which I wasn't born into, which weren't mine, but somehow were deeply influential in my life, and which I tried to get to the bottom of, and this seemed to be the link between them. Yes.
So, will you write another novel?
I probably will, I'm afraid. And it's I'm toying with one at the moment, which is set in the 1950s, in which a lot of things happened in Turkey, and none of them having anything to do with one another. and the idea was how to sort of link these various things that happened, including the first IMF conference outside of New York, Washington was in Istanbul, and yet that had a few oh, 2 weeks earlier the city was under martial law because there had been a pogrom in Istanbul, and so there's also, you know, all sorts of things happen, but how they join up is I haven't quite figured that out. We can do another podcast in a you know, but it won't be tomorrow, I promise.
I'll be looking forward to that eagerly. This is a hell of a good first novel. I really enjoyed it. So thank you for your time today, Andrew. I'm grateful for, I enjoyed the book tremendously, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to plunge back into the world of Sherlock Holmes. It's something I haven't done since I was a kid. It's one of English literature's most memorable characters.
Well, it's been fun talking to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Personal Landscapes. If you like the podcast, please give it a rating on iTunes and subscribe through your favorite app. You can find links to today's podcast and more conversations on Books About Place at ryanmurdock.com. You'll also find a donate button if you'd like to contribute to the costs of the show. All donations are greatly appreciated.